Later on, you were having an experience of openness and light.
I think it just me seeing this metaphorically, then when I closed my eyes, I think it just triggered that, took me out of the dullness and everything else into this whole other space.
Right, okay, into that other space. Now, if you were experiencing that still point, which you can while the yakety-yak narrator is still going, then you can. But it's something that's going on independently of the watcher. And that's where you want to be. You want to get to that place of just simply experiencing consciousness as the observer of phenomenon arising and falling. And that's what you felt like when you were at that. And I know you've had some pretty powerful experiences before, so you should know what that is. So, it's the fact that the narrative part of your mind is talking about the experience in the present moment. That's a really good thing, because most of the time the yakety yak narrator is all over the place, you know, and it's making judgments that is making judgments about the present, but it's not really being in the present. But the fact that that narrator is still going is a sign that there's still kinds of activity taking place in your mind that you would like to calm them down to. You would like to pacify the mind a little more completely. That's the complete pacification of the mind when you get the narrator to just shut up and you can, but it doesn't keep you from having the experience of being the witness to the phenomena that are taking place. And when you're not meditating, that's exactly what is taking place, is that consciousness is illuminating all of the different mental phenomena that are happening. The intentions, the actions, the perceptions and the reactions, and the witness, although you're not normally aware of it, you're not normally experiencing it, is always that still point that sees everything come and go and doesn't react and respond to it. What reacts and responds is something else. It's the mind, not rather than the consciousness itself. So, in the experience you had, while on the one hand, it would be very nice if you didn't have the internal self-talk taking place, but on the other hand, you can still practice coming to this place of experiencing the unperturbed witness, and even observing your own mind's reactions to this and that, your mind's reactions to its own thoughts and to its own feelings and things like that, from that vantage point. So what I'm saying is your experience was a good one. The thing to do is, you want to know where that was going in terms of no self. What causes us to feel as though we have some sort of self is that the mind creates the idea of a self, and that idea serves as the basis for all of the mind's decisions and its actions and its reactions and everything else like that. And that's what we might call the ego self. it is the constructed self. It's the self that is consists of concepts and ideas and all of our cumulative experience. It is exactly. It's something that the mind has manufactured to make sense of the world. In one sense, it's the little. It's the center of your universe. You know, your mind, from your sensory input, constructs a universe to account for sensory input. And the only way it can make sense of everything is to construct a center that is the I, and everything is then judged in relation to that self. That aspect of self is conceptual, and it's ideational, and it's emotional. And that is the aspect of self that you can really step out of. When you get to this witness place, you're pretty much stepping out of all of the construct. But what you're left with is the other part of self, which is this sense of being this separate entity, this pure, at a purely feeling nature, you know, purely feeling level. You still feel yourselfhood. And that you won't get beyond for a long, long time. That happens very late in the training process. But we actually all have feelings, all have experiences of the momentary or temporary non-presence of the constructed self all the time. Even people that have never practiced, they lose their sense of their personal self when they're totally engrossed in watching a movie. You know, and they engage with the character in the movie. And sometimes when you're sitting and meditating, you're just being there with the sensations, and, you know, and because this constructed self, it's turned on and off like a light bulb, or it's generated, but it doesn't have to be there. It's not necessary. And this is one of the ways that we get past our conviction that this self, that this constructed self is a real thing, is by having those meditative experiences when we recognize that it's not there. And this is one of the things that the witness experience helps us to do. Doesn't really get us beyond that also very concrete sense, inherent sense of being, being a separate entity. But when we're truly in that still point, when we're truly experiencing the mind doing its thing, and we're not identifying with it, then we're completely outside of the constructed self in that moment. Okay. The interesting thing that will happen, though, is that if we return our attention to the self, we immediately find it. It immediately turns on. It reappears. But we can have those experiences where we are just this viewpoint of consciousness, and from that viewpoint we experience our mind and the world our mind has created, and the sensations out of which the mind creates the world, and so forth. So that's the relationship to it. It's part of the journey. There's still a lot of self-identification in the witness, and that's why some people mistakenly attribute much greater significance to this experience than there really is. It is a kind of mystical experience, and it's an important one. But it's only a step along the way, and it is For one thing, it is temporary. And what we're looking for is a place where we become so completely convinced, we have total conviction at an intuitive level of the illusory nature of the constructed self. And so it becomes transparent. And so then even in our daily activities, when we find ourselves reacting, you know, you say something and then later on, for one reason or another, you feel like the owner of that statement and you've got to fight for it or argue for it or defend it or appear to be consistent with it. You know what I mean? The thing that you all know what that's like, right? So that's the operation of this constructed self. You know, it's part of the story of you. And so you're experiencing it then. And what we're looking for is to get to a place where even though the mind may still generate that experience, it's completely transparent. We know it's an illusion, and therefore it's so much easier, number one, not to act compulsively from that illusion, and number two, not to suffer because of that illusion. So that's where we need to get to go to. And the problem with the witness experience, although it's a very important thing to cultivate and to experience, it's an important, enlightening, insightful part of practice to come to that. But it's temporary, and you'll come back out of that experience, and you'll totally believe in the constructed self. And very often, you may even add now this new feather in the cap of the constructed self, that, oh, now I'm somebody that can have the witness experience that I read about in these books, you know. So yeah, and that's it. That's funny when you recognize that you're doing it, you know? And it's important to recognize when you're doing it. But that's the one problem, is that it doesn't. The experience itself moves you towards the gut conviction that this constructed self is an illusion, but it isn't in itself. It doesn't permanently bring you to that place. So that's the one problem. The other thing is, in the witness experience, there is still this very concrete core of selfhood. You've reduced your selfhood. You've basically eliminated all the attributes. All the attributes that you had constructed around the idea of self. And you let go of those. But right at the core of it, you still have this feeling of being a separate entity. And so that's why it's what I call the dualistic mystical experience. It is a mystical experience, but it is still very clearly dualistic. There is this observer, this witness, and there it is, that which is witnessed. And another one of the advantages of it is, it's actually mirrors. It actually mirrors one of the best qualities of it. You know, I'm tired, and so the things I say, sometimes I lose track. Okay. When you have this witness experience, and when you're observing phenomena arise and pass away, and when you're observing the activities of the mind, you see them in their emptiness. You see that they are arising and passing away, that they're insubstantial, that they're due to causes and conditions, and that they only carry the value and meaning that they seem to do because our mind imputes that to them, and it's not inherent within them. And so from the witness perspective, you have this appreciation of the empty character of phenomena, the empty character of the mind, the empty character of the constructed idea of self, if that happens to be part of what the witness is observing. But at the same time, it's making the witness itself into a much more concrete and non-empty reality. So it is very dualistic, and so that's the little catch in it.
I think it could go back and forth. It could be witness and then become solid self, and then witness and solid self.
That's right.
In the same situation. Yeah.
But the more time that you can spend in this witness state, then you are in the process of loosening the attachment to the constructed self, and loosening the attachment to the belief in the reality of your perceptions, that things are the way, because especially from the witness state, you see the ephemeral nature of all of your perceptions too.
What's the difference in the witness state and mindfulness?
Well, mindfulness.
Can you repeat that question?
What is the difference between the witness state and mindfulness? This is a good question. Okay. Most of the time, the vast majority of the instances when somebody's referring to mindfulness, they're referring to that function of conscious awareness as opposed to awareness that is not especially conscious. They're referring to fully conscious awareness. And we've talked about that before. I think you know what I mean by that, right?
Right.
Fully conscious awareness. Okay. So mindfulness refers to fully conscious awareness, and in particular, it refers to fully conscious awareness that has a very significant introspective component, so that in particular you're aware of exactly what you're doing in the moment. Exactly, and I shouldn't say what you are doing. Let's try to avoid that terminology. You are exactly aware of what is taking place in your mind at the moment. Secondly, you are aware of why that is taking place. And thirdly, you're aware of the appropriateness of it. And so, to be mindful, in your daily life, you're mindful of your actions, but you're also mindful of the motivations behind those actions, and you're also mindful of the appropriateness in terms of your beliefs, your practices, and so on and so forth. You know, whether or not this is something that you feel you shouldn't be doing or want to be doing. So you see, mindfulness, the way it's mostly used, refers to the experience of conscious awareness. Now, there is a much less frequently way, and much, you know.
You're doing fine.
Okay, yes. Much less frequently used way of speaking, but it's very important in all of the Vipassana literature, because after they finish talking about how to practice mindfulness, how to be mindful when you're eating, when you're defecating, when you're dressing, when you're, you know, when anger's arising, and all these, after talking about mindfulness in that sense, then they begin talking about the mindfulness that recognizes the three characteristics and that holds that awareness. And then they're talking about the mindfulness that sees the arising and passing away of phenomena. And then they're talking about the mindfulness that experiences the cessation, basically the experience of nirvana, the cessation of all mental fabrications, which is kind of the ultimate mindfulness. And they've made a subtle switch here, which is quite significant, because they've gone from talking about fully conscious awareness, which is a dualistic subject-object awareness, to speaking of what is basically the witness, which is the pure fact of consciousness of phenomena independent of the object. So we've sort of made a transition from here, whenever we speak of consciousness, we always speak of the object of consciousness. They arise as a pair, subject and object. In the witness state, we're starting to experience a separation between the between consciousness and the object of consciousness now, because consciousness itself seems to be uninterruptedly, unchangingly present, and objects of consciousness are what arise and pass away. And then, of course, when you speak of, then we make one more transition, which is to the mindfulness that knows ultimate reality, the mindfulness that knows the experience of nirvana. Because nirvana is not, it's not an annihilation, it's not an unconsciousness, it's not a gap with nothing there. Although in some kinds of practices, you know, people experience it that way, but most of the time, the one thing that can be said about it is that the person who has this experience was not unconscious. As consciousness was the only thing there. And so therefore it's sometimes described as pure consciousness with no subject and no object. And it's different from the witness in the witness experience there still is concrete core of identification with the consciousness itself. You know, so there's still the subject-object experience. So mindfulness also gets applied to the way that a human being is capable of knowing that they have had this very unusual kind of experience, non-dual experience with no subject and no object. So we would say that, and I'll talk a little bit about the transition there. So the witness experience, which is in the Vipassana tradition, is the experience you have when you're at the stage that's known as the equanimity towards formations. So you're experiencing the rising and passing away of phenomena with no attachment to them. And you are in this witness state. You're just seeing things arise and pass away. And in the way it's described, that's referred to mindfulness. Mindfulness knows the arising, and mindfulness knows the passing away of every object. And then ultimately, mindfulness knows what lies between the arising and passing away of object. And since the objects are the fabrications, when we speak of what lies between them, we're talking about the state in which mental fabrications have ceased. And so now at that point, we're no longer talking about mindfulness, mindfulness as the dualistic consciousness of the witness, but now mindfulness as the clear light of mind, as the consciousness that experiences the cessation and does so non-dualistically. So it has all of these different meanings. But 99 out of 100 times when mindfulness is used, it's referring to the quality of fully conscious awareness applied to the phenomenon that make up your experience moment by moment. And the quality of the mindfulness is dependent upon the degree to which it has these three characteristics of not only knowing what is going on, but knowing the causes and conditions, knowing at least the immediate causes and conditions, knowing the reason that what is happening is happening, and thirdly, knowing the appropriateness of what is happening, and how I'm holding those all three at the same time. That's the highest quality of mindfulness. And as it continues to be refined, and in a meditation experience, exactly those same qualities become knowing what's going on is knowing the arising and passing away of nama and rupa, rupa and nama, you could say, of sensations, of the mental formations that label sensations, of the reactions of the mind in terms of vedana, feeling, and the reactions of the mind in terms of perception and craving and clinging. So knowing the first act of, aspect of mindfulness, that of knowing what's happened, is actually seeing and recognizing this as it's taking place in your mind. This sensation occurs, produces this feeling, results in craving, results in clinging. And the second aspect, the causes and conditions. You understand well, I guess the two are really the same, they're closely related. You understand from the perspective of the Buddha's teaching, you understand why this is occurring. That the attachment to self leads to craving, so that when feelings, whenever something happens, whenever there's a feeling, a sensation, or perception that produces a positive or negative feeling, then the reaction is some kind of desire and aversion, and then the mind reifies the experience, you know, which is the clinging process. And then understanding the appropriateness of this becomes responding to it with equanimity, rather than embracing the compulsive craving and clinging that normally take place. So in the practice of mindfulness, you come to a place where, am I talking too fast? Are you following me all right? Okay. So in the practice of mindfulness, you come to a place where you're starting to see more and more clearly with each experience that you have, moment by moment, each thing that rises and passes away in your mind. You see it more clearly as it really is, that this is not a thing. This is an impermanent process which is appearing in my mind as a projection generated by my mind. And that if I cling to it, the result is going to be suffering. And you see this more and more clearly, and you develop stronger and stronger equanimity until the mindfulness brings you to the point where, through a combination of understanding things, understanding the true nature of this experience, and the powerful equanimity you develop, that there is no craving, there is no clinging, and in that moment, the fabricating activities of the mind cease. This is where your mindfulness is bringing you to, the practice of mindfulness. When the fabricating activities of the mind cease, all that's left is that which is very difficult to name, the clear light of mind, the Dharmakaya, but the wisdom consciousness. There is the wisdom mind that knows this, when the mind ceases to fabricate it, knows the nature of this non-fabricated experience as being the ultimate nature of all of the reality that has preceded it. And this is the transformative experience. This is the true non-dual experience. It is nirvana in that there is a cessation of craving, and that's what nirvana is sort of technically defined as. It is, some people refer to it as the experience of emptiness, but it probably more accurately is an experience of that which is empty, that which has emptiness as its nature. It is the experience of pure consciousness, because it is consciousness with no subject and no object, which is how it's pure. All other consciousness, all ordinary consciousness, you'll find it very, very difficult even to imagine consciousness without an object. Consciousness is consciousness of, but that's the nature of ordinary consciousness. It's always consciousness of something. So mindfulness is that which knows this experience when it happens. So witness, your original question was, what's the relationship between witness and mindfulness? Are they the same thing? And the witness is this intermediate transformative description of mindfulness.
It's along that continuum.
Along that continuum. That's right. Yes?
So on this path to that experience, if once you have that experience, do you cease to crave at all anymore, or does craving come back?
No, when you have that experience, what happens is that your belief in and attachment to the constructed self is completely altered. It is forever transparent after that. It's not something that becomes solid again once you come out of a meditative state. Or the witness can also be a non-meditative state. But it's not something that materializes into solidity again. It remains transparent thereafter. And the reason is that there is a cognitive aspect to the experience, and that is that you have known something that has finally obliterated the basis for the belief and attachment you previously held. And that's why I like to use the analogy with the experience of the little girl in Wizard of Oz.
Dorothy.
Yeah, you remember Dorothy and the Scarecrow and the Woodsman and the Lion. And they entered the hall and there's the booming voice and the Wizard of Oz, right? And quaking and shaking and afraid, and what do you want? Well, all we really want is, you know. But then they had the experience of peeking behind the curtain and found that there was a pot-bellied, bald-headed man with an apparatus that made all the sound and the lights and everything else. After they had seen that, it's impossible ever to believe. I mean, the next day, you can walk into the wizard's hall and the same booming voice and the lights, and they see it all. It looks exactly the way it did before. But there is one difference that can never be undone. They'll never walk into the hall and believe at a gut level in the reality of the wizard. And the same thing is what happens with that experience. And that's why it's referred to as an irreversible experience. You can't go back from it when you really have that experience, because something has changed in your mind at a cognitive level that it just, you know, it's like, how could you ever believe in the wizard again? You just simply can't. It has other effects which are not cognitive. It also seems to transform the way that your mind and your brain work in certain ways, so that it produces other, and they are related to that, but.
So the craving part then?
The craving is still there. Number one, it's there. You have a lifetime of conditioning, and this is what your brain and mind do. A circumstance arises, and it looks into its records, its official story of you, and it generates a response. And so you have a huge library of responses of craving and aversion. And they will still arise. But now, it's a very different situation because the root of that craving is no longer present. So that's one aspect of it. And the next part of the process is to work on eliminating that craving from the mind stream. You are not you are not so compulsively controlled by craving at that point. This is when I say there's a change takes place in the mind, that in the way the brain works, the way the mind works, is that you don't experience craving and aversion in quite the same way. But you will still, you know, your immediate responses, your reactions, will still be based on your past conditioning. And so this is the work you then have to do, that it's now possible to do. So long as you believed in the reality of your personal self, what you could do is recognize craving and aversion, recognize their presence, their arising, the actions that came about. You could learn to transform them, let go of desire and replace it with generosity, let go of aversion, replace it with compassion, understanding. You could make all kinds of wonderful progress, but the root, the belief in the self, was still there. And so, you're it's like you're constantly chopping the top of the plant off, but as long as the root there, it can always grow back.
Now you're just throwing away the debris.
That's right. But once you've dealt with the main root of it, now you can start really removing craving. But there's another subtle distinction to be made here too, of the kinds of craving. Now, once the belief in the personal self has been let go of, has become transparent, you can completely eliminate all of the craving and aversion that is associated with this realm we call the desire realm, you know, the world as we perceive it, sensual pleasures, you know, and sensual aversions, and desires and aversions that arise out of interactions with other people and things like that. You can, by doing the work, you can eliminate all of that. What you cannot eliminate, what you haven't eliminated, is that inherent sense of being a separate self. Even though you don't believe in the constructs, the attributes, to go back to the witness experience, there still is this point of consciousness that's seeing all this stuff. And although it, in the witness state and in the state after stream entry where the constructed self has become transparent, in both of these conditions, there is still this inherent sense of the self that is the observer of the phenomena that arise and pass away, even without the same kind of identification with it. And so long as that is there, there is one kind of desire that is still going to remain, and that is going to be the desire for existence. Perhaps not the desire for existence in this material realm, in a material body, but, and as a matter of fact, the desire for existence is so refined that there is a preference not to exist. This realm just seems so burdensome, so awkward and burdensome and troublesome. But there's still a desire for existence. And this is the condition of somebody that is called a non-returner. They still have this inherent sense of self, and even though they've lost all desire and aversion for the sense realm, they still crave existence. Actually, the other craving they can have is craving for non-existence, but it's mostly craving for existence. And that does not go away until one has become a Buddha, until one has transcended the inherent sense of self that gives rise to the desire for continued existence.
Why are they called the non-returner then?
They're called the non-returner.
Sounds like they're...
They're called the non-returner because this being will never return to the realm, to sense realm attachment and desire and aversion. The once returner still has to come into this world to finally uproot the last vestiges of craving. You know? And the stream enterer, who's also known as a seven times returner, is because he has so much accumulated desire and aversion, may fall quite deeply into the illusion a number of more times yet, but never so deeply as before, and it's only a temporary situation. So that's the allegorical sense of seven times returner and once returner and non-returner. Yeah. Okay, but there was another question over here that we'll come back to. Go ahead.
The way you're talking about the once returner, it sounds like, is there anything in that experience that somebody, like we're coming from, would relate to as an enjoyment of life? Because it sounds like there's still...
Oh, yeah.
It sounds absolutely. Like it's like, oh, we got there, and now all I want is to not exist. Sounds like a really long way to get this, to kill yourself.
This is the... Now, who are you talking about here? Which one?
Well, so the once returner, because you basically what you said was there's a desire either for existence or non-existence, but life is burdensome. And you're like, I'm ready to get on with this.
Oh, well, okay, the non-returner is the one who...
The non-returner, sorry, that's what I meant. Yeah, the non-returner. But, part of my motive...
Well, what the non-returner has is the same thing that the Buddha has, which is love and compassion for the sentient beings who still believe in their constructed selfhood. In other words, bodies and minds that are still suffering needlessly, conscious entities that are conscious of mind-generated suffering as an object. But the creations of the mind are beautiful in and of themselves. And Buddhas and non-returners are not incapable of appreciating that. They're just not attached to it. Mm-hmm. And yes, you can have an experience. You can have a similar experience. There are things that you can experience from a place of wonder and beauty that there is no part of your mind that is likely to generate any grasping for, any desire and things like that. A particular moment arises and, you know, a convergence of phenomenon that you have no control over and could never have control over, and they're so perfect and you appreciate the beauty and wonder of it, and you know there's no point in grasping it, you just enjoy it. Now, really everything in life is of that essential nature. Every single aspect of every single moment is a miraculous, astoundingly wonderful convergence of things of which you can never control. A Buddha knows this. So a Buddha and a non-returner are quite capable of enjoying the experience of being in a body, but with no attachment to it at all. No more than you would be. You would try to hold on to and grasp a perfect sunset that you saw. Right? Now you might see the perfect woman and you would have grasping. But you see the perfect sunset and you know that you can't grasp it, so your mind doesn't even try. It just appreciates it. Mm-hmm. Although, well, nowadays, we've even found a way to grasp things like that. You know, the person who says, oh, what a nice sunset. Where's my camera? Give me my camera. Can I borrow your camera? Where did it go? It's gone. So, compassion. Buddhas get out of bed in the morning out of love and compassion, you know, and so do non-returners. You don't really need, if you think about it, it only superficially seems that we need the compulsion of desire and aversion to live our lives. And we don't really.
I just read a really interesting story today about somebody who was sailing around the world in a contest, and it was a large cash prize, and he was going to clearly be the winner, so he had the fastest boat and he was the most skilled. But he talked about becoming, you know, it was the boat and him, but he talked about all of that silence and that focus, and he became the boatman, like him and the boat became the same, and he had this incredible experience, and he just said, oh, forget it, I'm not going back there.
Uh-huh.
He says there's lots to see, but there's no returning back to that life, because he had a whole experience that changed his perspective. And it sounds to me like he had a, in sailing and in silence, he had an incredible experience, and he said, I'm not returning.
There is, and there is, I suspect, I'd like to really, I'd like to read that description. Mm-hmm. What that sounds like to me, it's another very common and very important kind of mystical experience. That is the, it's the unitary or unified mystical experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where there is this, there is at this point, a once again, temporary experience of a complete loss of separate selfhood, and it's just a feeling of oneness with everything, you know, absolute non-distinction. So the eyes that see and the mountain that's seen are no different. They're part of the same wholeness, and there is no self in this process, and there's no more attachment to this body and this mind than there is to the body and mind are just simply seen as they really are, as a part of the whole of everything. And this is a very wonderful mystical experience. It's another one that's on the way. But if you examine this one, what there is still the sense of the projections of the mind, the world consisting of projections of the mind, are seen as real rather than being seen as projections of the mind. And so it is probably, I think, an excellent facsimile of what at least a non-returner, I don't know what Buddha's experience for myself, but I think it's a very good facsimile of the kind of thing that we're talking about. So there was another question from someone over here earlier before Terry asked her. Yeah.
If you don't have to answer today, I can ask it tomorrow.
If
it was simple, the difference between craving and clinging.
Craving.
If you could talk a little bit more about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a technical difference which is clear when you look at the words that are translated as craving and clinging that isn't really apparent within the English words themselves. The two different words, the one that's translated as craving is tanha, and it is it comes from the root word meaning thirst, or to have, you know, to be in a state of compulsively craving water.
Mm-hmm.
And it describes all of the compulsive states that we enter into, both desire and aversion. Once desire is the craving to have, and aversion is the craving to not have or to destroy or to avoid and so forth. But they have this quality of compulsion. They are compulsive movements towards or away from something. And the word that is translated as clinging or grasping, sometimes as attachment, is upadana. And upadana is from It's from the root for fuel. The fuel for a fire. And it's the fuel for the fires of craving and aversion. And what it refers to specifically is that when you have an experience that is pleasant or unpleasant and gives rise to craving, the mind creates its reality. In the very next moment, the mind creates the thing that was the source of the pleasure or the pain, or the potential pleasure or the pain, and the self that is the experiencer of the pleasure or the pain, and who is also the potential actor to obtain more of the thing that is pleasant, or to destroy or avoid the thing that is unpleasant. So upadana as the fuel is the mind's act of creating the illusion that we live in, of things and of a self. And so a word that most people in English don't know, but a much better English word, because it captures the meaning much more, is reification, which is when the mind makes something real. And so clinging is, the reason that clinging works so well is that we cling to the reality of the constructs that we generate in response to our craving. And they generate the whole experience that comes after that. If you see a person that arouses lust in you, your mind generates this huge illusory construct about who they are, which is not true at all. Or if you pass by a store window and you see an object there and it stimulates greed, your mind creates this whole thing about how you need that, how happy it's going to make you, how important it is, how worth it is, you know, selling your children to be able to get it. Well, maybe a little bit exaggerated. But you see, the same thing happens over and over again, 1,000 times every day. Is we have an experience, and the mind generates this whole thing, and we cling to that idea, and then it fuels our ongoing craving and our actions of becoming. That it leads to the actions that perpetuate the whole process. So, clinging, grasping, attachment, ultimately, they involve a mental process of generating an idea of something and some self and some relationship between the thing and the self. But the way that manifests in daily life are the things that clinging and attachment and grasping sound more familiar in context to, because we cling to the idea of that which we find desirous, or that stimulates lust and greed, or that stimulates hatred and aversion, and so forth. Right? So we cling to the thoughts associated with that, become attached to what we have and what we are. It is attachment to the idea of self that underlies our craving. So it is the upadana regarding the self as object that is the fuel for the craving. And that's why we have to get over the belief in the constructed self before we can begin to get over the craving that it has been fueling all of this time. I don't know if any of this makes sense. I am so tired. It's hard to believe I'm still sitting here and talking. But I hope it made some sense to you. I hope it was relevant and fit in to your needs somewhat. It all started with...
That answered my question.
With Allegra's excellent question. That's a very good question, Allegra. And so was Terry's, and so was Beatrice, and so was Adam, and so was Blake's. Good questions tonight. That's good questions, the only thing that could have possibly kept me sitting here and talking. Okay, well, let's say that's enough for this evening. Let's take a break, and then we'll come back and sit for a little while together.
Huge.